Joe Biden visits Asia for the first time as U.S. president. Just how different is his pivot to Asia from his predecessors? And how is the war in Ukraine impacting U.S. policy towards the region? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Sami Zeidan. It's now a decade after Barack Obama announced a pivot to Asia, and successive US administrations have talked about China's growing economic, diplomatic and military clout. Well, a year ago, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said China represented America's biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. But troubles elsewhere have obscured the planned focus on Beijing. Now, the U.S. is stepping up support for Ukraine in its war with Russia. So is that conflict challenging the U.S.'s long-sought strategic and economic shift to Asia? Our panel will discuss this shortly. But first, Florence Louis reports from Seoul on Joe Biden's first stop in Asia.
On the ground in South Korea, a mixed response to U.S. President Joe Biden's visit. These demonstrators welcomed him, seeing this as an opportunity to present a united front against North Korea. That follows reports leader Kim Jong-un may be about to conduct a seventh nuclear weapons test. But here, activists concerned about an arms race are calling for peace. When the two presidents met at a summit on Saturday, security was high on the agenda.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the principle of the Korean Peninsula.
They discussed enhancing sanctions and expanding the scope of combined military exercises. Biden also said he's not opposed to meeting Kim Jong-un if he's sincere. Both President Yoon and President Biden also said they were ready to help North Korea deal with an outbreak of COVID-19.
We live in an era where the economy is security, and security is the economy. Disruption in the supply chain caused by changes in the international security order is directly related to the lives of our people.
But analysts say that may not be enough to bring North Korea to the negotiating table.
Kim Jong-un regime appears to be determined to develop the military capability to make sure that North Korea will be armed to have a sufficient capability to hold U.S. forces and civilian populations in South Korea and in Japan as hostages.
Although countering China's dominance in the region was not explicitly mentioned, the Biden administration has made no secret of the fact it views China as a strategic challenge.
In Tokyo on Monday, President Biden will unveil the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Its members will include South Korea and Japan. Analysts say the U.S. is reasserting itself in the region, years after former President Donald Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact.
However, China sees that agreement as an attempt to marginalize it. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman criticized the U.S. on Friday, saying it should do more to contribute to peace in the region instead of creating divisions. Florence Louis for Inside Story.
Well, let's bring in our guest into the show now. We have joining us from Washington, D.C., Heino Klink. He's a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia and former military attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. In Beijing, Victor Gao, a chair professor at Soochow University and a former Chinese Foreign Service officer. And in Tokyo, Tomohiko Taniguchi, a professor at Keio University and a former special advisor to the cabinet of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Welcome to you all. If I could start with Heino. First of all, just how different is the Biden pivot to Asia compared to the Obama pivot to Asia or the Trump era policy towards Asia?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me today. I would say that the Biden administration has taken some very necessary steps to continue American focus on the region. As a Pacific nation, obviously, the United States has a number of interests, whether they be economic, security, cultural, and very close ties, having four treaty allies in the region as well. I, for one, don't particularly like the use of the word pivot, to be quite honest, because it kind of implies that you're turning one away from one region to turn to another. I think the United States, as a global leader, can and should divide its attention equally around the world. And I think, again, we can do that.
This is President Biden's first trip. To chew gum and walk, I think the expression is.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. This is the president's first trip to the region as the president. I laud that attention that is rightly placed on visiting two of our pivotal allies, South Korea, that just recently inaugurated a new president, as well as visiting Japan. Both very strong treaty allies, both allies with which we share common interests and, very importantly as well, common values.
Victor, when we hear policy experts or officials talk about focusing, that the U.S. is now focusing on Asia, how is that understood in Beijing? Is that understood basically as countering Chinese influence?
Well, first of all, I think ever since 1945, the United States has never left East Asia or Asia in general. So the so-called pivot to Asia is a misnomer to start with. Now, it is apparent that the United States government over the past several years, including during the Obama administration, Trump administration, and more recently in the Biden administration, they wanted to do something to contain the rise of China. Allow me to emphasize, first of all, this is barking at the wrong tree. Secondly, this will be a futile attempt, because the rise of China is a megatrend of our time. The United States will better serve itself to come to terms with the steady rise of China. Now, the other point is that in East Asia in particular, the megatrend is peace and stability and development, because we really do not want to have a war or confrontation, because peace will be most important for countries like Japan, South Korea, or China. And we want to promote peace rather than to follow the footstep of any country which wants to promote confrontation.
Interesting that the discussion very quickly often escalates into talk about, you know, war versus peace. I think it's very telling. I'm sure we're going to come back to pick up on that. But if I could bring Tomohiko in. Tomohiko, as Haino mentioned, South Korea's got a new president. Yoon Suk-yeol has campaigned to strengthen relations with the U.S. Japan's prime minister came to power last year, didn't he? Kishida Fumio, he's been talking about also working closely with the U.S. Does that tell us how much of an appetite there is right now to strengthen ties with the U.S. because of concerns about China? Is that the way things are going?
To maintain strong relationships with the United States has been and still is and will continue to be the top priority for Japan. The focus for next week with Biden, with Narendra Modi from India, and with the newly elected Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is going to be about Quad and Indo-Pacific. It's not necessarily a bilateral focus. The focus is going to be multilateral. And the scope they're talking about is the Indo-Pacific region. And the salience of Quad is going to be once again stressed by all the members, all the leaders participating.
Haino, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, is this basically an attempt by the U.S. to catch up with China when it comes to development issues, when it comes to integration, economic integration in the region?
I don't think so, no. As a matter of fact, much to many of my Chinese colleagues' chagrin, everything the United States does in the region is not focused on, quote-unquote, containing China. As a matter of fact, I think the United States played a big role in the so-called peaceful rise of China back in the last decade and beyond. I think that the United States encouraging and facilitating more economic integration is a good thing for all parties concerned, in that we all want economic growth to be the common denominator in our relationships, whether they be bilaterally or multilaterally. So this is something that should be welcomed by all countries in the region.
Well, is it welcomed by all countries in the region? Victor, how do you think China sees the potential of an expanded economic role for the US in Asia, but in a framework that, of course, does not include China?
Well, first of all, from the Chinese perspective, the US presence in the Asian Pacific region, if it is for promoting multilateralism, trade, and good neighborly relations, for example, will always be welcomed. China wants to keep its door open to the United States and to all the other countries to promote greater trade and good relations. On the other hand, if the United States' aim is to isolate China, to derail China, to set up blocks to put China aside, first of all, this is a wrong strategy to start with. Secondly, it will backfire. Why? Because China is the largest trading nation of almost all the countries in the Asian Pacific region, including Japan, South Korea, you name it. How can any country attempt to exclude the largest trading nation? This will backfire because this will really cause the United States to suffer the consequences. Allow me to use one single example. I hope President Biden will really bring back to the United States some baby formula, because you really cannot do things completely on your own. This is a globalized world. We need to have international cooperation of all kinds, rather than artificially setting up one bloc against another bloc of countries. China is a force for peace and stability of trade, and we want to open the door open as widely as possible to welcome American participation. Many American companies operating in China are making huge profits, sometimes more profit than their home operations in the United States. So I hope the United States government will follow the logic of market economy rather than dictate terms which violate market economy.
All right, let me take that point back to Heino. I mean, Heino, it could be argued, look, there was the TPP, which was much more of an inclusive organization, right? The US pulled out under the previous president, Donald Trump, and now Biden is setting up IPEF. Is it not able to see that that is really an attempt to cut China out or compete with it? Because that one doesn't include China.
Let me just, if I might, reply to some of Professor Gao's eloquent statements. I find it highly ironic that he cites our current baby formula issues, because I remember living in China when there was a huge scandal about fake baby formula being manufactured by Chinese companies that killed dozens, if not hundreds, of Chinese babies. So I find that, again, quite ironic that he cites our current difficulties. With respect to the U.S. market economy compared to the Chinese economy, which is, in fact, is not a market economy, when you consider the high percentage of state-owned enterprises, as well as the role of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, in every single company organization with the, within the borders of China. Again, I find that highly ironic. And I would also say, whereas I certainly support an open market and companies freely being able to enter and exit countries, China has levied many, many restrictions on foreign companies operating within its borders, whether it's the mandatory establishment of joint ventures, again, the mandatory establishment of CC party cells within organizations and others. And if you read more recent polling of Western companies, whether it's through the American Chamber of Commerce in China or the European Union's Chamber of Commerce, polling of its member companies, the trend lines are quite negative. And I think that's a reflection of the Xi government's heavy thumb on all aspects of operating in China. And I think you're going to see that the trend lines are going towards companies diversifying, whether it's using China as a basis for their supply chain, as well as diversifying China as a marketplace.
Right.
So hopefully there'll be some reforms internally within China to make it a truly welcoming country for foreign business.
Coming back to the question of economic blocs, maybe Tomohiko, how do countries in the region view this? Do they feel that they need to make a choice between closer economic ties with the US or with China? Do they have to choose between IPEF on the one hand and the TPP or the Road and Belt Initiative on the other?
Countries such as the United States and Japan, with full market economy and plus open and transparent government, must stick together to set the rules as high as possible, taking into consideration labor standard, economic, environmental conditions, and intellectual property, and so on and so forth. China is yet to overcome those hurdles. As was said by our American colleague, you get each and every company, not only state-owned company, but private company, effectively run by members of the Communist Party. It's not the economy we're talking about. The Chinese people may want to believe that their rise is peaceful, and it is certainly true that the rise is a mega trend for our century, but they are also rewriting status quo. Look, for instance, what they're doing each and every day in East Asia, in the East China Sea, and in the South China Sea. They are provoking territorial integrity of Japan, the Philippines, and Vietnam all the time, every day without exception. It's not something that you could call peaceful. And coming back to the economic framework, Belt and Road Initiative is a China-centric initiative, whereas TPP and the IPEF are open to the Indo-Pacific Indo-Pacific region's member nations. And they're setting the highest possible standard in order for China to catch up with.
All right, I think it might be fair to give Victor Gao a chance to come back in. I'm sure you have something to say about what our last two guests had to say. I'll give you a moment, Victor, before we move on to the war in Ukraine, how that's impacting policy towards Asia. Go ahead, Victor.
Well, thank you very much. Allow me to make several important points. First of all, I would say peace and stability in East Asia is the most important. If we look at Japan, amazingly, Japan does not have good relations with Russia, with South Korea, with China, or even with China's Taiwan province. It has territorial disputes with all these countries or province of China. And this is despite of the fact that Japan unconditionally surrendered at the end of the Second World War. So I hope Japan will put a premium to peace and stability and good neighborhood rather than try to rewrite history. Japan unconditionally surrendered, and Japan will make huge mistake if it invites nuclear weapons from the United States to be based in Japan, because this will be unfair to the Japanese people. Now, secondly, in terms of economic development, China has never forced any foreign country to enter China. All the foreign companies, hundreds of thousands of them, entered China voluntarily. If you give me any one country which is forced by China, by gunpoint or by coercion to enter the China market, tell me. You cannot give me any single name. Why do they want to come to China? Because of the size of the Chinese economy, because of the rapid economic growth. Around 2010, the Chinese economy was similar to that of Japan. Right. By today, only 12 years later, the Chinese economy is about 350 times that of Japan. So I hope anyone running business or you have a company to run need to realize that the megatrend is that China, whatever you call it, by whatever name, has its own momentum of growth.
And that it's a
and
major market.
And the growth
market.
Will continue.
Right.
And China cannot be excluded. China cannot be written off. This is the real megatrend of our time.
All right, let's try and catch a few minutes before the show wraps up. I want to come back to Heino and talk about the war in Ukraine. How much of a distraction has that been for the U.S. focus on Asia? Has it distracted U.S. not only attention, but some would say resources? I think recently the Senate approved an additional $40 billion in military aid or aid for Ukraine. Is that taking away something from the focus on Asia?
Well, let me first of all say what a tragedy it is that Russia, that continues to have very close ties with the People's Republic, and frankly, the Chinese government has supported Putin. It's a tragedy that they invaded Ukraine that has caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people. The United States, in conjunction with its partners and allies and like-minded countries all over the world, has come to the assistance of Ukraine in providing it self-defense articles. It again demonstrates that the United States can do more than one thing at a time. As far as I'm aware, none of our military resources have been pulled from the Indo-Pacific theater to support in bolstering NATO's defenses.
Right. So you don't think it's much
However,
of a distraction?
Well, I mean, again, it certainly causes our senior leaders and policymakers to focus on one part of the world, whereas, you know, many of us who have spent a lot of time focused on Asia Pacific would prefer for them to spend time focused on that.
All right. I think we've got a couple of minutes.
That being said, though.
All right. Go ahead quickly.
Just
wind up the thought, Heino.
The national defense strategy of the United States that was just published a couple weeks ago still says specifically that our number one priority theater is the Indo-Pacific and that China remains a pacing military threat.
All right. I'm going to try and get a minute to each of our remaining guests before we have to wrap up so everyone gets a last thought in. Tomohiko, how reliable is the U.S. in the eyes of some of the U.S. allies in the region when it comes to its approach to the region, when it comes to its commitment to multilateralism and alliances? We've seen the U.S. swing between the Obama era to the America First of Donald Trump. Now we're in a kind of a different approach again with Biden. Might this swing continue?
The U.S. presidents come and go, but the fact will remain that Japan hosts the largest military footprint of the United States. Without Japan, the U.S.-Asia strategy would not have materialized.
Right.
And so it is incumbent upon Japan to urge the United States, to incentivize the United States to remain firm in this part of the world. I'm not asking the United States to stay. I'm asking the Japanese government to do the best, to do the utmost to make the U.S. president as secure and as reliable as possible.
All right, we've got about a minute. Let me give it to Victor now. Does the war in Ukraine impact China's plans in the South China Sea, in towards Taiwan at all? Does it have implications?
Thank you. Allow me to make a first point. I think ever since 1945, the U.S. troops have never left Japan. In reality, the U.S. troops are still an occupying force in Japan. I hope Japan will focus on peace and development and will eventually regain its full sovereignty rather than being following the U.S. leadership in the world. Secondly, the Ukrainian war has its own logic. It is untrue to say that the international community is against Russia in this war. As a matter of fact, you are only talking about 30 countries or so opposing economic sanctions against Russia. And they are changing in the way they do the sanctions. The overwhelming majority of the countries in the world are not imposing sanctions against Russia. And I hope the United States will realize that China is not an enemy of the United States.
Right.
And the Chinese people are not enemies of the United States.
Got it.
So don't bark at the wrong tree when you want to figure out which country is your enemy.
All right.
China is no enemy of the United States.
Okay. Let's hope there'll be a lot less barking up any trees and the world can move towards a more peaceful direction. We're going to thank our guests so much for sharing their perspectives. It's been a wider range of diverse perspectives. I thank you all for bringing it to the table and to the show. Heino Kink, Victor Gao, and Tomohiko Taniguchi. And thank you too for watching. You can see the show again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, head over to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJInsideStory. From me, Sami Zeidan, and the whole team here in Doha, for now, it's goodbye.